Today on the Chris Stefanik Show, I'm with Tim Moriarty. He's appeared on Blue Bloods, Blacklist, House of Cards, Luke Cage, and Manifest. We'll dive into what that's like because that's really cool. It really
that's
is.
Pretty cool, yeah.
It's really awesome.
I introduced myself that way. I'm pretty cool. Yeah.
That's right. This is an awkward introduction. I'm kind of a big deal. So we're gonna talk about those shows, what it's like to be in those shows, because that's kind of awesome. Most of all, I want to talk about your spiritual journey, the journey from being such a devout Catholic that you almost became a priest, how the priest scandal drove you away, and a lot of people are going to resonate with this, from the faith in general, into Buddhism, into acting as not a career, but as an existential seeking, into Jungian psychology, into the overlap of Jordan Peterson with Jung, and who's made it popular, though most people wouldn't put the Jung name to it. They just know, like, hey, I agree with what the guy says. About the pluses and minuses of that, about your journey back into Catholicism. Did I cover it all?
I don't think anything more needs to be said. Really, that's it.
We'll see you guys. Yes. God bless you.
God bless everybody.
But all that's tied into one beautiful knot. And then I want to talk about what you're doing now with the Eucharist film and all that stuff.
Absolutely. So, yeah. Well, it's great to be here. I really appreciate it. I've been, admirer of your work. I'm really, really, really happy to be here and kind of, talk through some of this stuff.
Praise God. No, thanks for making time for this, man.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, there's so much to talk about here.
Sure, yeah.
And really, you gave me the overview on the phone in 5 minutes. I'm like, wow, I'm excited to dive into your story. So let's go. You're raised Catholic.
Raised Catholic. I was raised Catholic. Irish Catholic family, 5 kids. We prayed the rosary every night. From a really young age, I always felt, felt a sense of call, a sense of vocation. And it was like, it was I think small when it was as early as 5, 6 years old. But in high school, something happened and it's connected to the Eucharist. I had a carpool. We'd I went to high school in downtown Seattle and I got to school an hour early, and next to the high school was the cathedral. And the cathedral had a Blessed Sacrament chapel and it was shaped in the form of a burning bush.
Wow.
And for some reason on that day, I just spent half hour, 45 minutes there. And we grew up praying the rosary. So I just felt this kind of longing. And I kept doing that every day, sophomore year.
Wow.
And when I look at my life, there was something absolutely formative that happened in front of Jesus in that time. There was this kind of, just this deep sense of love, of longing that kind of went deeper and deeper. And then what would happen in the course of the day?
That was just him calling you.
It was absolutely,
you can't force that. I mean, parents could set the stage, but for a kid to feel like, I just want to pray a rosary in a chapel, it's like, that's just Jesus. I was in that headspace as a high school teenager, it's grace, man.
I think that's the way it felt as well. It was like, I was formed in this, then this was me, not just sort of doing what I was taught necessarily. Mm-hmm. It was this deep desire where everything kind of opened up for me in a way. Mm-hmm. But then I would have this experience in the course of the day I would walk over to class from, this experience of Jesus, and there was a sense of depth. There was a sense that reality was almost like that burning bush. There was a sense of transcendence. But then, I would start to notice that all of a sudden, and it was, from various reasons, would be thrown back into a world that felt very like two-dimensional. And it was thinking about, I gotta think about these tests. I gotta get to college. And there was this almost two different worlds. There was this world that opened up in front of Jesus in the Blessed Sacrament, where if there was depth, there was a kind of, the world felt almost on fire, and then there was this sort of flat, sort of where you're just bumping into stuff and you're just thinking, calculating what you're going to do.
I love the description. I want to rest in this and marinate it for a second.
Sure.
I love the description of a 3D world versus a two-dimensional world.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people think, well, the church, that's not the real world. The real world is this stuff.
That's right.
No, this is the world on fire. This is the 3D world, and this is flat.
Yeah.
If you're not careful.
And if you're not, and then this is a kind of fantasy, and you start to wonder, is this sense I'm having in front of the Blessed Sacrament, is this just my own imagination? Am I just sort of fooling myself? And then to be really serious and rational, I've got to live in this flat world, the flat lands, and just kind of go about building a life on that foundation. So it was a question of foundations. What's your foundation? So I think for me, there was a lot of things over the course of high school to college. I went to Boston College, and again, the formation was incredible. There were just great Jesuits there. Took about 4 or 5 classes with Peter Kraft. A lot of my best friends from Boston College.
Crave is awesome.
He's amazing. Just the formation of classes on C.S. Lewis and Aquinas.
He's lucky dog, man.
Really good stuff.
Seriously.
Lucky dog. And then it's funny what happens after all the formation to...
Yeah.
I'll get to that in a second.
Yeah, yeah. No, but I got to meet Creve once, and we were at this conference.
Yeah.
And both speaking at it, I don't think he knew who that guy was, but I took a picture, and he's pointing at me, smiling, and after we take the picture, he goes, I should be wearing a t-shirt that says, I'm with stupid.
Yeah, that's...
but he was just being jovial, right. And he's chuckling at his own joke.
Yeah,
and, he delights, like a little kid.
He is, yeah. He's kind of that absent-minded professor guy who is just delight. He loves, I remember we thought he was cool because he loved surfing. That was his thing.
Oh, yeah.
Right, the spirituality of surfing. And
book on waves and the meaning of all things is mind-blowing.
Unbelievable. He was great. But yeah, my community there, like Father Isaiah of the CFRs, he was one of my housemates. And
no way.
Another guy became a Jesuit. It was a really powerful time. So after that time in the... at Boston College, I joined the Jesuits. I felt this call, this sense of just wanting to go all in. And it was beautiful. I mean, it was really, I think it was beautiful. The discernment was beautiful in the discovery of Ignatius. And I think the genius of Ignatius in his use of the imagination.
Mm.
And that's something that's kind of come up, especially working in the artistic field. Ignatius knew that the imagination is a place where we meet God. I mean, in his spiritual exercises, the prayer that you're engaged in is you are entering into the gospel, you're talking you're observing, you're participating in your imagination in the story of salvation history, and it changes you, it transforms you. And so there's something there that really resonated.
As a
creative, I mean, Ignatius, he had a genius that this, the imagination is a meeting place, and it's a place where when it's sanctified, it can transform. It can transform behavior. It can transform somebody that's a sinner into somebody that's on fire. He knew that deeply.
That imagination muscle is so lacking in young people today. I had a friend who's a youth minister who was trying to get kids to meditate on a gospel reading and imagine.
Right.
And he literally was asked by a kid, like, how do I do that? I don't know how to imagine things.
It's interesting. Yeah.
They're just distracted. And
right.
Just scrolling.
I think that's, the more we ingest this kind of stuff where we're just fed, we're fed kind of garbage, the ability to engage the imagination becomes weaker and weaker. It's like a muscle. I think it's really devastating, actually, that the effect of some of this technology is having on the imagination.
Oh, yeah. That could be a whole hour on that, man.
Yeah.
We should sometime.
Yeah.
But you're about to become a priest.
So I was in seminary.
You're way in.
I was in deep, yeah. And they're a very close family member. I got a call from this person. And... had a recovered memory of being abused by a priest. And it was a very close family member. And it was like, get off the phone, what do you do with that? And so I'm sorry. It felt like the whole, and it was a priest I knew, kind of a family, And then kind of the weeks that followed that, the response of the church wasn't great. It was very kind of, a bureaucratic sort of process. And it did something to me that I think I always feared. I remember back when I would have these experiences in front of Jesus in adoration.
Yeah.
Back in my mind, I'd always worry, is this trustworthy? Would I lose this?
Mm.
Can I base my life on this or am I going to lose it? And it was a real fear that can I... And after this experience, very soon after, I felt like I was unable to pray. It was a very strange... Like intellectually, I could say, I know... that because this priest was a monster, it doesn't mean the whole institution is. But yet, on another level, there was no access there. I remember having a dream.
It's visceral.
It was just like, and I had this dream where it was sort of almost a cliche. But you remember in Braveheart, where the Irish mercenaries are being engaged by the British to fight the Scottish, and they're running with them. And then at some point, they sort of go to a jog, and they meet the Scottish. They shake hands, and they turn around to fight the British.
Yeah.
In this dream, it was a really strange dream, where I was there, and I was running with the church. And there were all these, those sort of ecclesiastical signs of, the cross and the bishop on it. And in the dream, I sort of came to a jog and a stop, and then I almost turned to say, is this the enemy? And it was a really strange, a very powerful dream.
Wow.
And it sort of spoke to where I think I was in this experience of feeling just total betrayal, just total betrayal by... this revelation of
That's not something you share often.
I haven't shared this before, ever. And, you know, and it's very sensitive to, you know, but it's also, I feel a tremendous sense of understanding of those who have left the church because of this.
Yeah.
It has been brutal.
Yeah.
The sense of the most sacred and beautiful institution founded by Christ. And I know these are human beings engaged in this, but still the sense of the office and the unworthiness that so many sort of lived their priesthood. And
I have a very similar experience.
Yeah.
That maybe sometime we'll go into in a whole show, but the most painful part was the aftermath and the bureaucratic response.
Yeah.
As a guy who has represented the church, talks about the pastoral care offered within the church, and to discover the entire response was bureaucratic and completely cold.
Yeah, yeah.
There was nothing fatherly or pastoral in the response.
Yeah.
And I had a profound moment in prayer that God really stepped in and saved me and helped me. But I looked at my cross and after experiencing this and I just felt the Lord saying to me, if you only leave my church, I understand.
Wow.
Not saying, hey, it's okay and all things are equal and there's no truth here.
Right.
But I felt like there was a building up in respect of me as a person.
Yeah. Yeah,
and it was the same kind of question he asked Peter, like, "Hey, will you leave me too? Like, you have permission to."
Yeah.
And I said what Peter did. I'm like,
"Right,
where else am I gonna go, Jesus? You're it."
That's
man.
Right. Yeah.
And some people are watching, and I get comments all the time from people who are like, "You're representing the church that abuses kids."
Sure.
And I mean, first of all, statistically, it doesn't abuse kids more than other institutions. It just doesn't.
Right.
Though it's more painful because we represent God.
That's right.
But I just want to shout to those people, like, you don't understand, man. Like, you're angry at that? No. People who are Catholics are infuriated by that.
Well,
like, the pain after McCarrick broke.
I know.
For 2 years, I was trying to pray.
Yeah.
Like, 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I was angry. Yeah. And I had to push past the anger and then pray. Because, like, this is tapping into the God moments in my life.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
That's sorry.
It's exactly right. It's exactly right that that the sense of betrayal and the sense of I kind of risked looking like a fool. I mean, people thought you're going to be a priest. So, but because I felt that this was trustworthy, and what occurred in my process there was, you know, the question of, you know, where else are we going to go? I went out and wanted to see what else is there. That's really what happened to me. I thought, boy, I can't pray anymore. I'd go to the chapel and it would just feel just brutal. Mm. Or I'd go to Mass and it just felt so painful to sit through.
Mm.
So out of that, I started looking around. I started looking into, I desperately longed for contemplation and for, but I felt like Jesus was no longer accessible. In that whole imaginary experience, the imaginary, not in terms of fake, but the imaginal, spiritual exercises, these encounters with Christ, I couldn't go there anymore.
But you still wanted the three-dimensional world.
I desperately wanted it. I desperately wanted that. Mm. And that's where Jung was a sort of figure that I fell into, where I was, I left the Jesuits after that. And to their credit, they were very compassionate and but I got to get out of here.
Yeah.
So I left. And then,
you went to Jung.
I fell into the arms of Carl Gustav Jung.
That's never before been said on my show.
I think so.
Or in my presence by anyone.
Well, nor should it ever be said again. You know, it's a strange thing to say. But yeah.
But more people are falling there than realize. And we'll get
they
to
are.
That.
He, I think he, in a way, has more to do with the way in which people think about spirituality than perhaps any other figure. And people who maybe are thinking Jung don't even necessarily know about him. But he's just his influence on spirituality, that whatever that term means.
Yeah, spell that out. Because this is becoming more popular because of Jordan Peterson, who's a Jungian, right?
Right.
But most people don't even know that.
Sure. Yeah.
They just like think I like how that guy thinks, and
it's
both good and bad. I mean, there's a bridge factor where people can, and I have actually a family member who, because of Peterson, came into the church.
Wow.
And that's I'm forever grateful, Peterson, if you're watching.
Yeah.
I also have a more distant relative who literally left the church after following a lot of Peterson. So
right.
when you're a bridge, you go both directions.
That's right.
And the one came in because he thought, you know, in this paradigm, in this way of thinking, that there's that Christianity fits.
Yeah.
This, and I have this longing for meaning and story.
Right, right.
The other left because they thought there's longing for meaning and story, but that's the thing.
Yeah.
And Christianity is just one possible fit.
Well, there you go. That's it.
And
yeah.
And then went the other way.
That's right.
But
that's
yeah, right. Sum up
yeah.
this
yeah.
experience for you
right.
and what it, I mean, honestly, just mm-hmm. educate us a little. Who's Jung? What's Jungian philosophy, psychology, philosophy?
I can share, yeah, because I'm not a scholar of him, so everything I say, you know, people
fact check. Sure, sure.
But for me, what he was Jung basically was responding to Freud. And so a lot of Freud was coming out of the tradition of 19th century reductionism, rationalism. And for Freud, all of one's psychological experiences could be ultimately, you know, reducible to sort of deterministic, materialistic processes.
Your springs and widgets, and you're predetermined to do certain things.
Exactly. And for him, the sexual drive is ultimately the life trying to propagate itself, and so are this kind of the id, which is these instinctual drives, are totally reprehensible to, you know, civilization, where we have to repress all that. It goes into the unconscious. And then because we're repressing it, it comes out in funny ways through neuroses, et cetera. It's a very dark and, you know, civilization and its discontents is ultimately a totally tragic view of life. Mm. Jung was came along just after Freud, and they were collaborators for a long time, and they had a break because Jung ultimately thought that he didn't like Freud's reductionism. He was not ultimately a materialist. So this is one of the reasons why a lot of, you know, people who are religious see Jung as somewhat of a, there's that phrase that people like now, he's an ally. But he was an ally in the sense that he was confronting some of the darker, more limited forms of reductionism. Mm. So for Jung's model of the psyche, the unconscious is not just this stuff that we have to hide down, this dark kind of id material that wants to go and rape and kill everybody. For Jung, he thought the unconscious was, he thought that what he called the psyche, which is the old word for soul, the psyche is ultimately consists of different parts. There's the conscious ego, which is the part that we're aware of. And then in the unconscious is all those parts of ourselves that we're not aware of. Mm. And that his model is that what one must do through life is to become fully individuated, is to become to make conscious the unconscious, because the unconscious isn't just garbage, it's actually good things. It's potential, it's fullness of life. And he interpreted all of myths, he interpreted different stories and religions from that framework. Mm. That's where people like Joseph Campbell, A Hero with a Thousand Faces, he's using Jung's model to say, well, that's what this myth means. Jesus, for Jung, is the archetype of the self. So he takes this religious language and story seriously, but on his ground, which is the ground of a psychology that is kind of a psychology of self. Mm. And for me, I resonated with Jung because it felt like I was still being spiritual. It felt like I was...
Without having to be religious.
Without having to be religious. Yeah. And well, that's exactly right. And it was sort of trying to find my own myth. It was trying to find my own story. And he also follows kind of Nietzsche's call to sort of get back to the earth, Nietzsche's move towards creativity. So that kind of Jung with Nietzsche led me to think about, this is sort of how I moved into the acting thing.
But it's a spirituality under your control.
That's right.
Right?
That's
there's the flip that I don't know Jordan Peterson's soul, right?
Right, right.
But there's if he becomes a full-blown Christian or follows his wife into the Catholic Church, that'll be the flip. It'll be, here's a seeking that is under my control. But,
right.
But ultimately, that's about you.
Right, right.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, you're not bowing to something.
That's right.
The flip will be, Jesus isn't just a story that fits the narrative or our human need.
Yes.
The human need is there because
yeah.
God put it there, because this is real.
Right.
And I now submit myself to someone else's lordship. I mean, that's the spiritual posture that is.
It's totally different.
It's upside down.
It's totally different. And for me, this is a good example where I would have dreams, sort of religious dreams or whatever, but I would interpret it from the perspective of, oh, these are aspects of myself that I need to integrate so that I can become whole. So I mean, exactly as you're saying here, Christianity is totally different. The ground, I mean, this one thing that really hit me with Jung is there's an essay he writes about marriage, and marriage ultimately for him is a means by which I become more aware of myself to become greater and greater, this part of this, you know, more and more myself. I become individuated.
Hopefully he knew not to share that during date night.
Well, meanwhile, he's having affairs with multiple people so he can get in touch with his feminine side, apparently. So there is this aspect of Jung that, as you say, the religion is a religion of self. I got into it to such an extent that I started to train as a Jungian analyst. This was later on after doing the acting stuff, and had even people that would come for, sort of training people that would come and pay less at the Institute, and I would sort of supposed to be doing Jungian therapy with them. But it was this, what came to the fore, and we're kind of jumping ahead, but I think it's totally fine, what came to the fore with Jung, the limitations is that there was no place for worship. There was no place for love.
Mm.
There was nothing there where I would encounter the other as other.
Mm.
You know, I was always encountering myself everywhere I looked. I'm projecting out there. I'm encountering this, even if I'm looking at the outer world.
Mm.
Maybe it's a projection of some part of myself that I need to integrate. You know, with this kind of spirituality without without an encounter with grace that
profound
just takes, you know, bowls you over and you just can do nothing but fall on your knees and worship. You know, there was none of that.
Mm.
And I long for that.
I want to hold that thread and come back to it.
Sure, sure.
And hit the acting thread.
Oh, yeah.
How was acting not just a career, but part of the spiritual quest?
Yeah. Well, for me, it was, I had, when I was in the Jesuits, I had kind of wanted to go the philosophy route, and I started to think, there was a sense of trying to grapple with ideas. I think when I left, I was just really lost. I was living just in this sort of weird kind of cabin place in Seattle and just deeply so depressed.
Yeah.
So depressed. And I was teaching freshman religion.
You can't be depressed in Seattle. Where can you be depressed?
Oh, that's true. You're right. I was in the right, just guzzling down coffee, just like a drunk. it was in that experience where, again, going back to this whole sense of the vertical and the horizontal, I felt like the vertical was, I'd lost access to.
Wow.
And so what do you do? Well, the modern sort of post-God is dead approach to that is you become an artist. You know, that's art is a sort of horizontal form of transcendence because I am going to create my life. And for me, my family had done some acting and there was some, you know, I thought this would be a form of art where I could really give myself to. I could explore different aspects of the psyche by playing different characters and I could stop being, you know, I had become a little bit too heady and bookish. I thought this would be a way to kind of really get in touch with the body and the emotions and just try to, so I went to, you know, did a
horizontal
degree
in transcendence.
It feels that way. I think that, you know, I think that when that world of depth felt I couldn't get there, but I still wanted it. And so it was the sense of art would be a means to do that. Instead of art reflecting the transcendent, it became art as expressing myself, I suppose, or expressing, trying to get in touch with aspects of myself that I wasn't, you know, aware of so that then I could be, you know, in the Jungian language, more of a whole person.
Wow. I love nuggets like that, the phrases like that, horizontal transcendence. I'm going to hold on to that one.
Yeah.
I mean, that sums up the entire ethos of the world right now.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? When there's no vertical transcendent.
Right.
And all we have is this.
Right. What can you do?
The only thing you could do is imitate actual transcendence by going all the way in.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, that's why, like, if you're hedonistic enough, you can become euphoric.
That's right.
And get out of yourself. And that's somewhat like actual spiritual life.
That's right.
But it's not.
Yeah, yeah.
And to seek that in acting,
yeah.
I'm going to guess a lot of people do, but almost no one actually puts it to words like you just did. And you had an awareness that you were doing that.
I think it's become... without having access to the vertical, if you haven't tasted that, maybe then you don't really know that there's any other kind of transcendence. You know, I mean, I had an acting teacher who was, you know, he was very open about, you need to go out there and experience everything and let your imagination free and go, like, whereas Ignatius was disciplined with the imagination, in this form of imagination, like studying, you know, people like Stanislavski and the whole method acting approach, you would use the imagination like Ignatius would use the imagination, but you would use it to transform into characters that were given to you by writers. So you'd use the magic if. So if I was in these circumstances, and you would really allow your imagination to kind of fill in all these details, because then it would affect feelings and it would affect behavior, it would affect posture.
Wow.
And it made me understand what Ignatius was doing, where he's feeding you the gospel, he's feeding you Christ, because that's going to affect you. So the imagination, again, was this kind of thing, but using it not for that vertical transcendence to become Christ, but using it to explore different aspects of myself through these characters.
Wow.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Your debut in Blue Bloods was
It was a really big deal. Let's just put it that way.
Tell us about.
Well, there were three different audition periods for this role, and I had one line. I had to go to three different auditions for it. It was the role of a priest, which I thought, at the time, well, this is really ironic. In the casting director's like, you look just like a priest. And I was like, oh, well, that's a very bizarre thing to say. Yeah. So my line was basically to escort Stacy Keach, who played the Archbishop, and Tom Selleck was there to meet them for something. Yeah. I had one line, which was, Your Excellency, as I was sort of escorting Tom Selleck. And that was it. And I was deathly afraid I would forget the line. So that's the glamour of acting. That is what I was going for. And I made it. Chris, I made it.
Yes.
I did it.
Yes.
And I got that credit. I was on Blue Bloods.
That's awesome. That's kind of cool, though.
Big deal, yeah.
No, nothing right now, Mr. Herman. Sorry, that just came to
Yeah, that's right.
They put someone else's voice over, but it worked. I got my face in there.
It's all about letting people know that here I am. Look at me. Yeah.
But it obviously got bigger. Which acting role were you most proud of?
You know, it's funny, acting. So on theater acting is interesting because you could play a lot more range.
Yeah.
When I was in New York acting, I started to get typecast as like, I would be like FBI guy or NSA guy. Yeah. And, you know, here's another.
You look like I can see it.
Well, I thought, you know, can I play some range? But it was always just. I guess the one that had the most episodes was Manifest, which for a while was on, you know, it was NBC and moved over to Netflix. But that to me was
you
also
progressed beyond the Your Excellency.
I did. They gave me a couple more lines. I was pushing papers around and actually had to go try to get the bad guy. But that was. I think acting is interesting. I think it's a noble profession. I think there are people who really approach acting from a deep, there is a way in which if you're telling stories that are pointing to the good, it is a beautiful craft. Mm. And then there's a little bit of kind of a newer form of acting where it's really just, I mean, there was times in grad school for acting, I thought, boy, these people should be in therapy and I should be in therapy. There's a little bit of like, I need to be famous. I need to be somebody.
Yeah.
So that side of acting, it's hard to say was I proud of it. I think it was I was working stuff out. And but I also kind of really did fall into this whole kind of idea of this heroic sort of I'm on my own. I'm not going to take a survival job. I'm going to go broke unless I get the, you know. Wow. There was a kind of sense of I think maybe without thinking of grace, I was going to do this thing. And I didn't even know why necessarily I was doing it, but by God, I was going to do it. You know, I'm going to make it. Even though I knew make it was just, didn't really have a, there was no real definition to what that word meant, but I was going to do it.
So let's pick up that thread again. Jung acting.
Yeah.
And something happened that changed your entire spiritual posture. Not your mind, but like how you were interacted with reality from
big
I'm
time.
In control to
I'm
receiving something.
You know, this was about a decade of searching around and doing this, and I never stopped sort of going to. I would always go to churches when they were empty, you know, when it was dark.
Yeah.
And I would try throughout that period to go to Mass, and sometimes I could do it, but sometimes I would just leave it the homily. But I felt this growing kind of gnawing sense of just this desire for worship. It kind of goes back to that whole the limitations of Jung, the desire to just surrender and to. And to love, I mean, just and to be loved. I always thought these archetypes are they don't really love me. There's no concept of that. There's a sort of this breathless God who's the hound of heaven coming. There was always this sense of I got to relate to this archetype to sort. And so I remember reading totally kind of unrelated, but Marshall McLuhan, who was a media theorist, and he talked about his own conversion, where he said the only way that you can really test this is if you take it on its own ground. You can be on the outside investigating this thing, but he said faith has oftentimes been thought of as I'm intellectually assenting to something. It's not that at all. It's a way of seeing, it's a posture towards the real. And the only way you have access to that is to take it on its own ground, and the only way to do that is to get on your knees.
Oh.
And I remember reading that, and I knew it was true, and I hadn't been able to do that because I felt kind of afraid of what would happen if I did that again. What would happen if I really sort of said, you know, did Ignatius's Sushupe. What would happen, you know, if I really prayed that prayer?
Wow.
So that, but I knew
what
I
needed. What were you afraid of?
I felt a little burned maybe from 10 years ago. I felt I knew that nothing I had tried from, you know, the other periods I'd gone into yoga quite deeply and Zen and this the Jung stuff, and I always felt something was missing, but I was afraid of, I don't know, I was this, I, the third, Christianity's dangerous because I'm not in control. And it's this other stuff is, you're like playing around with God, you know? It's like Jung in his Red Book talks about meeting a dying God and he does therapy with the God and explains to the God that, this is in his sort of work that he had done throughout his life where he's basically trying to create his own almost new religion. And he meets this dying God and he tells him that he's actually a sort of an imaginary figure. And this heals the God, but the God shrinks down to the size of an egg. And David Bentley Hart wrote about this in First Things. So basically, Jung took God and put him in his pocket, like as a toy to play with. And it's true. Whereas if this other thing was scary because God's might have that sense of call, that sense of vocation, the sense of something breaking into your life might happen.
Oh, Christianity is dangerous because you're not in control. Yeah. You have great one-liners, by the way.
Okay, well,
There's, wow. I mean, there's people waiting for the great, great minds, and again, not to bring up again, Peterson.
Right.
If we can explain it just right to this guy.
Right. Yeah.
If he gets all the pieces in place.
Yeah.
No.
No.
The pieces being in place doesn't lead to faith any more than figuring out that my wife is the right person
leads me
to marriage. It only leads me to the threshold.
Yeah, yeah.
There's an act of will that pushes intellect beyond where I can go alone.
Right, right.
That says, will you marry me? And I believe, credo.
Yeah.
There's a different space there.
There is. That's
not to be anti-intellectual. It's actually important, but it only leads to the threshold.
It does. And then it's not anti-intellectual. It's beyond. It transcends what the intellect is. The intellect's a great tool.
It's like love.
It is.
It's like the other.
And this is what happened after I decided to do that and started to...
Decided to pray.
I decided to pray again and said that old prayer, show me. And then not soon after that, I went to Mass.
Soon after that. Okay.
That's right. Yeah, good.
Not soon after that. Okay, yeah,
no, go. Get my timeline out. It was a Sunday night, and I was in Manhattan, and I had come from a Jungian analyst thing, and it was a little bit, I'm here, I'm talking about my nonsense. And it was, this whole thing was just drying up. So I went to Mass at St. Catherine of Siena on the Upper East Side. I'd never been there before. Didn't even know if they had Mass. Stumbled in there. It was fine. It was Dominican parish. And as I was leaving, opened the door for an old couple and basically bumped into this girl and just randomly said, hey, do you come here often? Which is a great line. Those of you out there looking for a wife, there's your line. You come here often? Do you come here often? And so we started talking. I lied and said that I was taking the subway. Actually, my car was across the street, but I needed more time because there was something there. So I got her number. And within 1 year from that meeting, we were married.
Wow.
It was a concrete experience of something totally unexpected, and it's just a total gift, like this kind of meeting another, and she became, you know, now we're, you know, two kids, and this, from that experience, this, the whole access, I think, to, and I'm still, the healing that I think is still coming, you know, working, that I'm working on with my heart, family and everything, it's still in process, I think. But the absolute conviction that, you know, as you said, where else are we to go? I mean, nothing else has the goods. I mean, in my experience, that I can say that I've tried these things. It just, and the way in which grace works, way in which God breaks into your life with surprises.
And love. Ultimately, he used human love to change your spiritual posture.
It's exactly what it is. And that's where also, I mean, going back to where we started, that the Eucharist as, in, you know, you say this well in the film, this tangible expression of God's love.
Yeah.
That's not just in my mind. It's not just the spiritual thing where I'm doing, that's separate from the body. It's separate from my history. It's separate from my family. It's just, it's the concreteness of it. Mm.
Yeah, so you've put all this gift and this gifting that you've developed in your foray away from faith, right? At the service of the church now.
That's right.
You know, tell us about the Eucharist film. Tell us about the other films too, where people could find all your stuff.
So the company that I started was Castletown Media, and we've been working now in trying to bring, I think some of the insights about storytelling, about the imagination, trying to bring some of like really high production quality to tell the story of our faith by in a way that's really beautiful, in a way that's compelling. So we've had just the privilege of working with the Knights of Columbus recently on the Mother Teresa, No Greater Love film.
Phenomenal.
It was from that that met Jim Wahlberg, who's just become a great friend.
And that was like, I think, number two film in the country for...
For documentaries,
Yeah, for a couple days.
That's
at least,
right.
Which is a big deal.
It was a huge deal. It was and I give a lot of credit to, you know, the team that was there and the Knights that supported that. And then this film came about. Jim has a great relationship with Deacon Steve Greco of Spirit-Filled Hearts and gave me a call about last year and said that Deacon is interested in doing this film on the Eucharist. And it felt so providential because it was the very thing, you know, early on in my own life that was everything that led me towards.
Wow.
And so it was like this is just another example of God working that says you need to go back to this.
Praise
in a
God.
Deep way. In a way that is going to heal you. And that's this process has been with this film. We wanted to show the Eucharist and engage, you know, the truth of it in terms of the theology, the biblical side of it, the biblical roots of it, but also the goodness in terms of showing lives that have been transformed by it, but also the beauty that doing it in a way that might provoke, that might invite somebody to say, man, there's something here, let me try it, you know? So that's one of the, you know, that's really what we're doing now is to try and engage the imagination, to engage the senses, to re-enliven people. And people who, you know, I have such sympathy for, who feel like they're on the outside because they say, well, you know, and I know that. I know what it's like. But there's something so freeing and something so beautiful about just taking that move where you take Christ on his own ground, you just surrender to that. Mm. And the healing that has been coming is profound.
Praise God. Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing the story, man.
Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate the opportunity.
And I'm really, I'm just so grateful that the Lord let you go on that crazy journey, because now that's part of the story of you leading people into, I watched the Eucharist film, and it's the kind of thing I'm not afraid to share with people who are into the faith.
Yeah, yeah.
And you could tell it was made by a guy who took that journey.
Right. Right,
you know, and wants to lead people to the greater reality.
Yeah,
knows how to do it. So I'm grateful for you. This has been a gift to me. Yeah,
likewise. Thanks so much for having me on. Really appreciate it, Chris.
Yeah, thank you. Love you guys. Thank you so much for watching. Be sure to like, subscribe, and share. I hate to land on such a
it's
a profound, total profundity. And please like and share. Please like me. But you know what I mean. It's about spreading the good news. And make sure you go see, what's the URL for the Eucharist film?
JesusThirstFilm.com.
Beautiful. Share that one with the world. I love you guys. Thanks for being with us.